the rear truck started feeling a little bit of shift in the ice, and he picked up the transmitter for the radio, and as he picked it up, it broke through the ice. And he transmitted, we're going in.
Jesus.
Fortunately in English, not Icelandic. Or maybe now that I think about it. And he transmitted it. And already he couldn't get his door open going through the ice.
Whoa.
And now we're talking about, this is 400 kilometers from the nearest next person for sure, of 300 miles. And waning light in the most populated polar bear region of the world, about minus 28 degrees with about a 20-mile-hour wind. And so he yelled over to our indigenous guy, door, door, door.
What's up, everybody? Thank you for listening to the Smoking Tire Podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Groove Life. Never heard of Groove Life? They have reinvented some of the staples of men's wardrobe, right? And mainly, we're talking about belts. Are you using the same belt you've been doing for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years? The belt is a very old design, but it's time for a major update and a rethink. The Groove Belt has a proprietary webbing engineered with just the right amount of stretch, and Groove Life designs the world's baddest buckle. It snaps using rare earth neodymium. Neodymium. That's magnets set in an aluminum alloy. Trust me, your waist will thank you. This belt is comfortable, almost infinitely adjustable. You can micro adjust it for the big meals or the small meals or the I haven't eaten for 3 days and I'm feeling very skinny. You can micro adjust all of it, and whatever happens to your Groove Life gear, they're here to help. They've got a 94-year no BS warranty. Why 94 years? Because the average life expectancy is not that. I don't know. I'm guessing it's like the house that my parents have in South Carolina has 27 mile an hour speed limits, and it's 27 instead of 25 just because you'll remember it more. 94 years. You will remember a 94-year no BS warranty, making the Groove Belt the last belt you'll ever need. The buckle includes what they like to call stiff tech. That's a fancy way of saying there's no annoying belt flaps that need to be tucked in anywhere. The Groove Belt is good for the office, the woods, the backyard, the club, and everything in between. Plus, it never needs to be adjusted. You just put it on and forget about it. And they don't just make belts. Groove Life has wallets, rings, watch bands, AirPods cases, and much more. The everyday carry, as it were. They've grown from a side project to a company that now provides for over 100 families, recognized by Inc. magazine as one of the fastest growing companies in America. These products are very high. The wallet seems like you could run over it with a car, and I really like the AirPods case. I am about that. It's time to bring your belt into the 21st century. Head over to groovelife.com/tire and use promo code TIRE for 20% off all Groove Life products. That's the best offer you will find anywhere, but you've got to use my code TIRE for 20% off your order. One last time, groovelife.com/tire and then promo code TIRE for 20% off your order. Also brought to you today, of course, off the record, our favorite law assistants. They're not a law firm. They connect you with lawyers, right? So the way it works is you get a ticket. Oh, no, that ticket's bullshit. Most of them are. You go to off the record. You do not plead guilty. You go to offtherecord.com/TST or use code TST10 on the Off the Record app. Right? Send in your ticket. They fight that ticket by connecting you with a local lawyer in the jurisdiction where you got the ticket. You don't have to do anything else. You don't have to go to court. You don't have to fill out forms. You don't have to appear. You don't have to do anything. They handle it for you. 97% success rate, folks. If they don't get those points off your record, your money back. So go to offtherecord.com/TST or use code TST10 on the Off the Record app. 10% off all legal services from Off the Record from your friends at The Smoking Tire. All right, folks, today on the Smoking Tire Podcast, my pal ACP, Andrew Comrie Picard, is in studio. He is a legendary rally driver and also the founder of Zip Tire, which is a company I use here at the shop all the time. But he's really here because I want to talk to him about this crazy adventure he went on driving across the ocean. That's right, frozen ocean on these Arctic trucks, which are these trucks from Iceland designed from driving on ice. Wait till you hear this story. It's crazy. I love this dude. ACP, Andrew Comrie Picard on the Smoking Tire Podcast. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. You
know, welcome in.
I'll let you take the lead. I brought my own cheat sheet here.
You have a cheat sheet? Yeah, what's on it?
I don't know.
What are you cheating about?
I'm very nervous.
Why?
Because the quality of your podcast has gotten so good.
That's just because the lights are bright.
It's just bullshit. Oh my god!
You've talked before. It says TV host on your website. Oh.
I know. It's just shit that I.
This cheat sheet stinks.
Does it?
I mean it. Well, I guess if you know what's on it, but
no, it doesn't. It's not for you. I wanted to send you stuff, but you just
did. You have to write. Did you write love EVs because you love EVs?
You know what happened? I'll be completely honest with you. I don't listen to podcasts that much, but I've listened to yours lately, which is really great. And I realized that the dialogue has gone in such interesting directions. And I wanted to make the point that I do love EVs, but I think that your understanding of them is so much more sophisticated than mine. But I've got some opinions.
Okay. Well, that's fine. It's not a contest for sophistication. Just that, like, there's a lot to it. No, there's a lot. A lot to it. Like, remember, like you were there. You weren't there, but back in the day, you probably are aware. Before gas stations existed,
I'm glad you think that I might remember.
You know, well, you have the knowledge. You weren't there, but you know a lot about the history of cars and. Have you ever been to Germany and you've been on the route that Bertha Benz took when she took the first ever road trip?
I know of that story, but I haven't been on
it. There's a literal drugstore. And the first gas stop on her road trip was a fucking drugstore.
Right.
And it's like, there weren't stations. So and if you think about the Peking to Paris drives back in the day, or the Thomas Flyer, that kind of shit.
Yeah.
Like, there was no gas. And so we're at that point. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can fill up at home. But presumably, if you had a car at that time, you had a supply of fuel at home of some kind.
You had to be resourceful.
You'd have a drum or something.
Yeah.
But, like, that's where we are now. We're in this thing where we've got the car, but we can't figure out how to fuel the fucking thing.
I think it's fascinating. But not only that, the fueling doesn't happen instantaneously. You have to wait for the fueling to happen. And that's the real problem.
It's like a fourth dimension adds. Like time.
Yeah. Like, imagine if it took you 40 minutes to put gas in your car.
It would be crazy.
It would kill everybody.
You'd
mash it yourself. Like, now you have to distill corn.
Right.
You know.
There'd be riots.
Or some stations would flow it at 2 gallons a minute, and some stations would flow at
this mechanized pump.
Right.
It's like that. It's like, oh, well, the 12-year-old that pumps our gasoline by hand with the crank, he ran out of food, so he's a little slow today.
Well, and even, you know,
it's dark though.
You see that Volvo outside?
Yeah.
I'm really into this Volvo.
It looks good.
It is, like, so nice. I'm really into it. It's a totally unexciting and uninteresting vehicle in the grand scheme of the shit we normally drive. But it's a plug-in hybrid. Mm. It can do 40 miles on its electric battery.
Which is mostly you need every day.
The electric motor is on the rear axle and makes 145 horsepower, which is fine for city driving.
That's what my RX-7 had.
And then the 2-liter turbo gas engine comes on. It makes a combined 455 horsepower and 523 torque, which I'm guessing is more than that GTO you drove.
400, yeah.
And then you can keep driving forever. And the engine isn't, like, particularly inspiring, but it certainly gets the job done.
That's a silver bullet vehicle. That's what everybody needs.
I've learned this from driving it because I have to plug it in more frequently than our regular electric car. It actually, Zach, you may find this interesting. It, on a level 2 charger, which we have here and which we have at my house, it takes about twice as long per kilowatt or per mile added as the Mach-E. The Mach-E's onboard charging unit is faster.
Interesting.
And so,
is that because of the architecture in the XC as well?
Yeah.
Right. So it can't
take as much. You also can't pull up to an Electrify America DC
fast charger in this. You can only plug in at home. So it's not horrible, but whereas the Mach-E, if you plug it into my Level 2, it adds like 10, 12 miles per hour. This one adds like 7. So it's just a little extra time. I think I said in the video that we made that you can charge it up in 2 hours. That's not exactly right. It's more like 3.5. But anyway. So there's that element of now you've got what can the station flow and then what can the car accept.
Yeah.
It's a lot of variables.
I think it's culturally so interesting, you know, because I've raced. Are we on now? Are we like?
Oh, we've been on.
Oh, okay, great. Because it's interesting for me to see that there's still cultural resistance to EVs, and you know, especially in I've raced the Baja 1000 a few times. I come from that kind of tradition, and there's still. I noticed at King of the Hammers, I wasn't there this year, but there was a whole thing where Optima Batteries brought out a bunch of EVs to do like a desert run in them, and the fallout on that on the social media from the sort of King of the Hammers community, let's say, was still as vehement as you could possibly expect it to be. And I love that people in our space or in your space, really, like the real, you know, the Road and Track, the Car Magazine, the real, the authorities really are into it. And even the car all the car enthusiasts are into it now.
Part of it is that we're forced into it because a lot of the new cars that are coming out are electrified in some way. And so if we want to talk about cars, it's unavoidable. Those of us that have a little bit more of an open mind, Zach and I this past weekend went to Nitro Rallycross.
Oh, yeah.
Jen was out there. Jared Deanda was out there. Travis Pastrana was racing.
Pack, yeah,
yeah, your old crew. Yeah. And the racing was great. And so if you talk about electrification of motorsport, if the racing is good, I don't really give a shit. Like Formula E is kind of boring. I'm not that into it. If you take away the sound from that type of homogenized racing, but if you take away the sound, but you put in jumps, sideways action, rubbing into each other, crashing each other out of the way, well, now the racing's exciting, and who gives a shit if it's electric or gas?
I think it's like about that packaging. Like you said, at King of Hammers, there's this resistance. So I drove the Hummer SUV like 2 weeks ago, and GM said that 40% of the buyers are new to EVs completely that have ordered a Hummer. And I think it's about like putting
the
electrification.
The for.
What? Right.
The
no, it's a gateway
for
drug for them.
Yeah.
But like the King of Hammers folks
I'll
that
buy
are against
EV
it,
if it's
if
more
they,
wasteful
if they rode
than
in a Wrangler that was electric. Like we've off-roaded a bunch of electric things, and it blows you away because there's torque from zero, and it's just really easy to manage. So they'd probably be more open if they experienced it. But if they don't want to even have the experience, then of course they're like, well, this is stupid.
Yeah. Well, the easiest people to win over are racers, obviously. Like I remember 12 odd years ago when Monster first brought the electric car over to do the hill with at Pikes Peak. I was running an Evo. We were practicing like at the top of the mountain. It was the first year that Romain Dumas came.
Right.
And he brought his car fresh from Le Mans, the GT car fresh from Le Mans. One of his first times on the hill. We were practicing the playground at the top, from Devil's Playground to the top. And we were all timing each other the first corner. And Romain Dumas takes off with a 7-speed GT3, you know, Le Mans car. Wow, gong, gong. And it's beautiful. Sun's just coming up. You know, dust is coming back off the wing. And we time him to the first corner. And then Monster takes off. And we're like, almost forgot to start our watches.
Because you didn't hear it.
Right. Right. Yeah. takes off. And it was 2 seconds faster the first corner. And we're all like, well, that's
to the
that
first
then.
Corner.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah, yeah. But I also work with Ford. And to your point, actually, with the Hummer, we were playing around with the Lightning 2 summers ago. Now the early Lightnings, the prototypes, and we were bringing in like select people to check it out. And half of them were either were pickup owners, like people who had all had. One guy told me, "I've had every F Series since the first one. I'm real excited about this.
My Model T was great."
Exactly.
They don't make them like that anymore.
Well, they don't. And as you know, I have one.
That's for the best.
But on the other hand, there was like a young couple who had never had a pickup truck. And now they're trying out something with the frunk, and they've got a secure storage. Plus, they've got the usefulness of a pickup truck, and everybody loves it. You just can't get one. Mm-hmm. But I'm a performance guy too. It drives great. The center of gravity's low. It's incredibly powerful. It's fast off the line. Once we win the charging infrastructure, they're gonna dominate.
We're probably 10 years from that, maybe 15.
Oh, yeah?
But it's. Because it's just complicated because it's property rights and it gets into something beyond the cars. Like here at this building and at my new building, I know what it's like to try to get power somewhere now.
Right.
And it's a bitch. Like, it is not. A lot of these places, like they just, it's not that they can't, but the levels of governmental red tape or property ownership rights and just shit you need to divert the energy to somewhere to build a large, fast charging station. It's a lot of power and it's a lot of moving parts. It's just very difficult. And they just, I'm sure someone somewhere has thought about which needs to be done first and blah, blah, blah.
I don't know. I think that people think about things less than you would think. The older I get, the realize I think a lot of it happened by accident.
That's actually probably not far off. And, and most of the time, you know, at least at the higher end, which is where this stuff always starts, people can charge at home or work most of the time.
Yep. Yeah.
But the more I drive this 40-mile small battery pack Volvo, the more I go, you know, this actually is in terms of getting people into an electrified future that fits in their lifestyle, because people don't want to be inconvenienced, right? I don't want to buy this thing that I then have to deal with. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be forced into this thing that I then have to deal with. But but if you can drive 95% of your driving on electricity, it'll be pleasant. It'll be emissions free, and then you can just keep going and not have to find charging in public. It eliminates a lot of headaches.
Yeah.
It's good.
I just love, you know, I love the broad history of vehicles. I love that it seems like nobody saw it coming, or almost fewer people saw it coming than you would expect, right? The move off of hydrocarbons. And that's fascinating to me. You know that in like the early teens, you had an equal chance of buying a steam car, an electric car, or a gas-powered car.
You ever see like one of those Baker Electrics actually driving?
I've seen Detroit Electric drive.
Yeah. It's kind of weird when you see, because it actually looks like a horse carriage kind of, and it's just like moving by itself.
It's a horseless carriage.
Kind of creepy and weird.
Yeah.
But there's a guy, what's that? Is it San Marino Grand Prix, the one in like Pasadena here? Mm-hmm. There's a guy, it's at this park, and there's this ring road that goes around. It's actually quite a good concours, considering it's just like a local event. But there's a dude who's got a Baker Electric that works, and he just drives like laps silently around the thing the whole time. It's pretty badass, actually.
10 miles of range, 5 miles of range on lead acid batteries.
Probably. Yeah, no, there's one that was on display that had the original batteries, and then this guy had was upgraded to modern batteries, and it goes like 100 miles.
Of course, it doesn't weigh anything.
Because it weighs like 800 pounds.
Yeah, it'll match with you in it.
Yeah. Speaking of things that weigh a lot, can we talk about Arctic trucks?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, the very first time I saw Arctic trucks on Top Gear, I was like, well, that's amazing. And for years, I was like, well, why have they not tried to sell these in America? And then you texted me and you go, hey, I'm working with Arctic trucks.
Yeah.
They're going to be bringing some trucks to America.
Yep.
So what made them finally decide to sell trucks in America? And how's that going to work?
Well, so as you know, Arctic Trucks has a long history. So it turns out if you want to drive on a glacier, the very best people in the world to do it are from Iceland, because they have a glacier they can drive on all year.
Yeah.
So there are so many people in Iceland that are keyed into this glacier driving stuff. And the basic premise is very large flotation tires and very low pressure, so you stay on top of the snow.
Literally like 5 PSI, right?
Oh,
it's
down to 2.5.
2.5 PSI.
Yeah, that's pushing it. But 5, you're fine. 4 can be like the magic point. And actually, the difference between like 3 and 5 is huge.
Really?
Yeah, the difference between 35 and 37 on the road is barely noticeable. 3 and 5 is a completely different beast.
Sure.
So, and you can drive over your arm. You know, there's so little pressure per square inch that you can actually, you put so little pressure down on the ground, that's how they work. They're like snowshoes. I've been on the glaciers in Iceland and like gotten out of a Hilux and sunk up to my hips in snow.
But the car is still up on top.
6,000-pound truck is sitting up on top of the snow.
Because the footprint is now whatever, you know,
2 by 3 feet. It spreads out so much. Yeah. That's so cool.
So what happened, I mean, my involvement is kind of weird because, you know, I rally raced for a long time and off-road race and stuff. And then I kind of was getting out of that and I was trying to figure out what's the hardest thing that I can do with a vehicle. And I started pitching a pole-to-pole expedition to go from the South Pole to the North Pole. Still has never been done. And in that, because I'd work with Top Gear also, I reached out to who we'd worked with in Top Gear, which was Arctic Trucks. They did the UK Top Gear, as you know, the 2007
North
Magnetic North Pole. Yep. And then we did a bunch of stuff with them at Top Gear USA. And so I reached out to the owner, great guy, Emil Grimson, and all the Icelandic guys. They're very funny. But they have this incredibly like well-developed knowledge of how to drive on snow there. And right down to like, I had a call yesterday pretty much talking exclusively about wheel bead styles, because of course it's really important when you're down incredibly low pressures.
Yeah.
We're now innovating new solutions and stuff to this. But to answer your question,
is there something beyond the bead lock?
There's a lot of things. There's the external bead lock that you know of the plate on the outside. There's also internal bead lock, which is something that pushes out from the inside.
Uh-huh.
But the very bead profile, like the bump, and you know I'm in the tire business anyway, there's the bump and then the actual profile of where the bead meets the wheel.
Sure.
It makes a difference also, especially as the tire deflects as it gets and it gets to really low pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, to answer your question, the reason they came to America was I just think
that's fucking awesome.
I have one in Detroit right now,
really?
If you want to play with it.
They look so cool.
It's going to be, yeah, and our factory's in Cheyenne, Wyoming. We've built several vehicles now there already.
That
this is, by the way, this is all scoop stuff. Nobody, I have not told anybody about this
Woo!
Yet.
So
this
Exclusive.
Is all, this is on you.
Social
yeah.
media guys, make
YouTube
clips.
Title.
Yeah.
Make clips.
Yeah. So basically what happened is the Icelandic guys were really, really good at this. They focused a lot on the sort of expedition ultimate capability stuff. They've done 370,000 kilometers in Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
In Antarctica?
Yeah.
Do they just like leave trucks down there?
Yeah. We have a bunch of trucks that just overwinter down there. After COVID, they had
to
go.
Like there's more shit in Antarctica right now than there's ever been. Between the ball, like there's, I like a couple months ago, like every B-list celebrity was posting about going to Antarctica on their Instagram. Am I crazy?
There is a moment, both for the Arctic, you know, because Nito just did a run to the high north too, and Antarctica is getting a lot of play right now. I agree. I don't think there's that much on the ground, much more on the ground there. There's not much on the ground there really, except that there's a number of vehicles that are used every season to support scientific and not really tourism, but a little bit.
Ecotourism.
Well, sort of, yeah. But you know, generally, if you want to go to Antarctica, you fly Union Glacier and you do something from there, maybe drive to the South Pole. Or for example, when Prince Harry did his Wounded Warrior ski to the South Pole, Arctic Truck supported that with vehicles, you know, to tail along and support. Anyway, the expertise was developed in Iceland, and I think that either there was not the appetite or just not the people weren't ready to come to the U.S. And a couple of players within Arctic Trucks, including the founder, Emil, and a couple of other Icelandic guys, really wanted to make it happen. And then we talked about it over time, and we're still only a small group of people here, but we have a factory in Cheyenne, Wyoming. There's a European investor who's not far from there, so we've got the seed money and it's all going up. And we found that there's so much pent-up hunger for them, and actually not so much, well, I think there's in the retail segment also, but in the commercial, mining, and government segments.
Sure.
That we've almost been just so inundated with interest from those fronts.
Like the Sherps. Like Sherps are they went from, what is that? I've never seen it before. To like now they're popping up kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
And I had to go on one of those.
Oh, yeah.
It was the fucking jam.
Oh, they're
amazing.
Yeah. They're insane.
But the model I keep thinking of with Arctic Trucks is actually more like RWB, actually, where, you know, it's not handcrafted the same way. You know, it's not like a chain-smoking Japanese dude with a fucking Sawzall and a welder. But he's got his main, you know, shop in Japan, and then there's these kind of satellite shops, and he'll ship parts down there, and they'll do the install locally. Like, I felt like since the Tacoma and the Lexus GX and like the stuff, the cars that we had were like pretty close to what they were doing over there, that they could satellite it out and build trucks somewhat locally.
Well, so you sort of put your finger on it. What we've done is tapped into the engineering that so many of the guys in Iceland have figured out so well. And now we're building them here sort of to the same specs and industrializing a little more to make it more repeatable. They're still very hand-built, honestly, especially because you know what the jam is. We put on very large tires but don't lift them or lift them in the minimum amount possible, because when you're working on glaciers, you can deal with cross slopes. You don't want to have a big brodozer.
You don't want a high center of gravity.
Exactly. So the whole jam is to really keep it low, and that means a lot of fender. It's funny, I never thought of the parallel with RWB, but in a way,
you're cutting over fenders. I mean,
it's very similar, right?
Yeah.
We have our own fender. Yeah, you look at that, it kind of looks like an RWB truck now that you mention it.
Guys, let's take a quick break for NASCAR. This episode of the Smoking Tire Podcast is brought to you by NASCAR, and the 2023 season is officially underway. A handful of new races are now under these drivers' belts, and you can feel the competition really start to heat up. Up next, the drivers and teams are headed to Austin, Texas to compete at COTA, the Circuit of the Americas. And this track is massive. 20 total turns throughout the course. Road course NASCAR racing is my favorite kind of NASCAR racing. The drivers are going to need to stay locked in the entire time if they want a chance at taking home the checkered flag. It'll be interesting to see how the drivers handle in their first road course race of the season. There is definitely some road course aces competing, like IMSA star Jordan Taylor, F1 world champion Kimi Raikkonen, and AJ Allmendinger, who was so close to winning at COTA last year. Don't miss out on the awesome road course racing action. Tune in to the NASCAR Cup Series race on Sunday, March 26th, 3:30 p.m. Eastern, 12:30 p.m. Pacific on Fox.
That the fenders have to, you know, they still conform to European regulations, Icelandic regulations, where the tread is completely covered by a fender. But the goal is you keep it so low that it's usable. And because the suspension is fairly soft, a little like a Raptor, it's actually very usable every day. It's drivable. They got really big tires that are hard to balance. And 44 inches is kind of the sweet spot for the tire that we use a lot in the expeditions or in the commercial or mining government work stuff. But we have, around the world, there are other arms of Arctic trucks that build down to a 35-inch, but the goal is to not lift at all, really, to keep it really low. So what you end up with this look, you're right, it's a little bit like a 911.
It looks RWB-ish, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and that's you know, the great thing, the thing that I love most about the brand and about all the engineering is that it's 100% authentic. It was never done to look cool.
Right.
It's cool because of what it does.
Yeah, the looking cool is a side effect of it, and I also like that it's typically, like, although sometimes they do it with bigger vehicles, like the typical Arctic truck is like a Tacoma or a Hilux or a midsize, and not a giant, you know, Ram or F-250. I mean, I know they do some of the vans, the E-Series vans, and some of those are pretty cool. But
well, in fact, yeah, you've got a Sprinter up. Yeah, that Sprinter is hard to build.
And that Sprinter's got, like, the limo door, too. It's got, like, the
well, and those, I think, and I've seen, like, they have F-350s or 250s that are stretched with six doors. It seems like that's aimed at tourists.
Yeah,
like,
that's the Glacier
money,
tours.
We give you the ride, we take you to the Glacier, all that stuff.
So the answer is yes to all of these. All of these vehicles are possible. We're actually, and I'd appreciate your feedback and even your audience's feedback of what is most in demand. We know that for our commercial clients, and we're working with people in Canada already, like a Super Duty platform 6x6, because we build a 6x6. We move the rear axle forward and backward, so we split where the rear axle is and put
is
one in front behind.
Six driven wheels?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
And it's a transfer case hand-built in Iceland. It would blow your mind.
There's only like two or three people in the world that actually build that 6x6 transfer case. I think the other one is in Texas somewhere. But
is that right?
I think so.
I'd be interested to know that, because right now we're flying them back and forth to have them built.
Actually, I mean, I imagine who do you think builds Mercedes ones for the G-Wagon?
Yeah.
I wonder where they got that from.
Steyrpook.
Probably, yeah.
So, but we know already that some of our commercial clients, for what they need to do in the mines and stuff to carry stuff, they need that 6x6 capacity. We used, when we did we did this overland run to the Arctic last year in March, first wheeled overland expedition from the continental shelf to the high Arctic, and we used F-150s for that. We built three of them, one Power Boost Limited and two diesel F-150s.
Oh, hybrid? Is it a hybrid one?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I drove the hybrid.
How'd it go?
Great. Yeah. I mean,
hybrid's pretty sweet.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I called Ford about some of the engineers that I work with them and said, hey, you know, what's your cold weather testing? And they went, you know, it's Northern Michigan and stuff. I said, okay, so I'm going to be like minus 35 for three straight weeks. And there was a little silence on the phone. They're like, yeah, well, can we get the data?
Yeah.
So, you know, the truth is when it got really cold and stayed really cold, the battery didn't operate a lot.
Yeah.
But because it was a hybrid, we were able to get through everything. I drove it from Yellowknife to Cambridge Bay, which is over the tundra and over the Arctic Ocean up Bathurst Inlet.
Wow.
Which was astonishing. I mean, it's an astonishing achievement, really.
Is it hard driving?
It wasn't hard. The vehicle isn't hard to drive. The terrain was hard to negotiate because you have a certain amount of snow, and then under that you have, in certain places, a certain amount of rocks and certain shapes of rocks, and we had to really work the terrain.
You can't always see them.
Right. And so we rely on very accurate satellite data imagery to plot our course. And also, we can do a certain amount of slope work, but anything real steep down or up is hard.
It's like you're going in and out of like a harbor, and you have satellite images like, oh, well, it's shallow here. Here's where a reef is. You have to go here. It's
exactly.
Like the same thing. Wow.
It's a lot like amazing. That. So it was a great experience. Took us a few weeks. We went 2,200 kilometers, ended up in Resolute, which is basically the northernmost populated community. There's a military station further. But,
yeah.
And developed relationships with the local indigenous people. They gave me an indigenous name, which is incredible. Like, I work with the northern tribes now.
What is your indigenous name?
Omilgoktok.
Is there a translation for that?
It means man with thin lips.
That rules.
But yeah. It's not that I have particularly thin lips. It's that it's a name of one of the elders that had passed away there. I have this incredible, it's for me as a Canadian, it's incredible to have this kind of relationship. But where I'm going back next month too, we're doing another 3 weeks to go north with amphibious vehicles and go around, which I can describe later. But the point of the Arctic Treks is that I think that there just wasn't the bandwidth to bring it to America. And now... there was a pent-up government interest and market that we already knew would be here. So we said, let's land it, and it's in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and see what happens next. We're going to go to like Overland Expo this year.
Sure.
We're going to go to SEMA. We're going to bring out a couple of trucks and see what people want, because we're capable of building so many different ones. But initially, they're going to be the expedition vehicles, but it could be, we're working now directly with BF Goodrich, it could be that it's a 39-inch or 42-inch, a little more tractable on the road that people can use on their ranches in Wyoming, or keep in mind, we do central tire inflation is a big staple of this. It's not just the fenders, but it's controlling the pressures, which also works on the sand. And there has been in the past military applications in the Middle East.
Sure. Hummer. My Hummer had central tire
inflation. CTIS, yeah, right.
It was a pain in the balls.
Well, exactly.
I'm sure the technology has come along a little bit, but my O2 was kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
It wasn't good.
Yeah, I've always wanted one of those Lamborghini O2s. But the central tire inflation is crucial, and we have our own bespoke system, and we think it might also be interesting to people in the desert.
Mm-hmm. Does the package, like if you build a package that's meant for glaciers, does it work just as well on sand?
It's very similar, yeah. I mean, there's certain cold weather versus warm weather preparations for the vehicle you do.
Yeah.
But in terms of the tires and suspension, you're dealing with very similar things. It's like you don't want to press down too hard.
But it's not, even though it looks like a trophy truck, it's not meant for going fast.
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
That's kind of the difference, right? Like, what happens if you took one and treated it like it was a trophy truck? Would something terrible probably happen?
Well, I mean, the good news is that... we don't make anything smaller, but we do rely on OE spec stuff to a certain extent. But now you're dealing with a wheel assembly that's like 200 plus pounds.
Yeah.
So, you're going to, if one of our constant worries actually when we're driving over the Arctic Ocean, and we had this worry in a couple of places, is if the surface of the ice breaks or you start to go through, there's the potential to sink. But the first thing that happens is all your wheels rip off, because you got a 6,000 pound truck going at even 15, 20 miles an hour, and one of those wheels stops because it broke through the ice. You just tear it off right away.
Whoa.
So the biggest thing—
They won't float though, will they?
The trucks? No. You know, we sank one.
Did you?
Yeah, on the March expedition. So we
had— One of the F-150s you sank one?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
So we had seven vehicles going north, four Russian Yamelyas, which are Sherps on steroids, hand-built by a Russian expeditioner named Vasily Lagin, who's become a good friend of mine.
How do you spell that?
Yamelya, Y-E-M-E-L-Y-A.
Y-E-M-E-L-Y-A?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so those—
bigger Sherps, yeah.
Yeah, all four of those are ours, and they're currently in the Arctic.
Huh.
This is Transglobal Car Expedition I'm speaking on behalf of now. They float.
That's not a car.
These float. No, it's not. Actually, you know what? You'd love it. It uses a turbo diesel Toyota pickup engine from the European market, centrally located right between the front and rear axles, and turned in line, which means that the transmission linkage is upside down. So you shift beside you, and it's like first is over.
Oh, it's reversed?
Yeah, completely reversed.
It's like a Bugatti Type 35.
Right, yeah, exactly. So we had four of these and three of the Arctic Trucks F-150s. And the goal was we wanted to leave these in the Arctic, because when we do our around the— – so this is the whole thing. Next year, the Transglobal Car Expedition, we're doing the first ever around-the-world expedition vertically. We're starting from New York next January to the North Pole. These have already been to the North Pole, the geographic North Pole.
Okay.
No other vehicles have been to the geographic North Pole. That's why they're
doing the long way up down.
I know there is a difference, but what is the difference in real world?
like 3,000 kilometers.
The difference between magnetic and
the other thing is
and the terrain is in previously impassable, so it's just further.
Magnetic North Pole drifts, right? And so in the 1850s, it was like almost just off the coastal shelf of North America. Mm-hmm. And now the Top Gear expedition in 2007 or so was to 1996 Magnetic North, which is just above like the last major island.
Okay.
And now it's drifted quite close to the geographic North Pole.
Okay.
But geographic North Pole, the only wheeled vehicles that have ever been there are these.
Okay.
And it was over the course of like a 2-year expedition 10 years ago, right? And it started from Russia. So that's why these vehicles are now up there for our expedition. We're going from New York across the North Pole with these, the length of Greenland, which Arctic Trex has already done, then Europe and Africa, and then coast to coast in Antarctica, which nobody's done except Arctic Trex. We last year did that within 10 kilometers. The last 10 kilometers of the Marguerite Peninsula ended up being impassable for weather. But normally, as I said, when you go to Antarctica, you fly to Union Glacier and then go to wherever you need to go.
Yeah.
Going across Antarctica is a different beast entirely.
Sure.
And in order to be authentic, to drive around the surface of the Earth, except for where we have to take boats on the water and we're trying to do minimum possible.
Well, you said they're amphibious.
Yeah, those ones are. You're right.
You can't do an ocean crossing in a truck.
Well, yeah, I know. I sit up at night worrying about stuff like that. But we have to come to the coast of Antarctica with an icebreaker, drop them to the surface because there's no infrastructure to do this. Drop them to the surface of the ice, drive them up on the continent, go to the other edge of the continent and similarly get them out.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's a big effort. Anyway, so the point of the story is that we went north with the 7 vehicles. I stayed in the community of Resolute, which is a very far north, 80-ish degrees north community. And the 3 F-150s just went to skedaddle with the Icelandic guys back to Yellowknife, where we needed to restage them and to bring them back down here in order to prepare for the next round the world, you know, for when the round the world exhibition starts, right? On the way down, the Icelandic guys were traveling really, they're traveling very well. We had great conditions. We had all the ice data. We carry along a ground-penetrating sonar with us, so we know the thickness of the ice the whole way along. And they were just following the exact GPS.
Is that mounted underneath the truck like a fish finder on a boat?
It's about a 12-foot-long, 10-foot-long bar across the rear that we hang off the rear on a trailer.
Oh.
And it sends down a ping from one end. It goes down and penetrates the ground and comes back up to the other side. It basically finds water. It finds how far down the water is. Yeah. So then we take out how far it is from the surface of the ice, you can calculate it that way. So they were following all the data going south, and the sign of waning light and so on going on. 2 trucks actually were together then, 4 guys, 2 in each, including an indigenous, local indigenous guy that we'd hired, Brandon, and a guy named Torfi driving the second truck. The leading truck is the heavy one, pulling a fuel trailer. And the rear truck started feeling a little bit of shift in the ice, and he picked up the transmitter for the radio, and as he picked it up, it broke through the ice. And he transmitted, we're going in.
Jesus.
Fortunately in English, not Icelandic. Or maybe now that I think about it. And he transmitted it. And already he couldn't get his door open going through the ice.
Whoa.
And now we're talking about, this is 400 kilometers from the nearest next person for sure, 300 miles. And waning light in the most populated polar bear region of the world, about minus 28 degrees with about a 20-mile-hour wind. And so he yelled over to our indigenous guy, door, door, door. He pushed his door open. They stepped out. They had their shoes off because they'd been walking or they'd been driving for like an hour or 2 hours,
so
right?
They're just chilling.
Yeah.
They're not ready to get out of the truck. Yeah, they're not ready to get out of the truck. They're comfy in the truck.
So they step out onto the ice and they watch the vehicle start to go down. Torfi, who's a pretty wiry guy and really aware, realized that all the camping gear and stuff was strapped to the roof of the truck. He jumped back on the truck as it was sinking, unstrapped it, started throwing it to the ground. At the same time, the truck ahead had stopped about 50 yards past and stopped, or maybe it had gone 100 yards past, turned around and came back within 50 yards, stopped. And they throw the stuff off. The truck goes down in about 45 seconds in about 25 feet of water.
Whoa.
Yeah. So then this was my only concern ever for this whole expedition. So then they get whatever they can, scramble back to the other vehicle, and then they do a little reconnaissance around them. And straight ahead of them is completely open water. Now, we've been over this route
like
5 days previous.
Open water?
Yeah. 5 days previous, we went over this route, and it was more than 60 centimeters thick. We only need about 30 centimeters to hold up 6,000 pounds. In 5 days, it had gone from that thick to gone.
Oh, my God.
And that was new learning for us. Yeah. And so we have been working with there's an indigenous ice thickness organization called Siku.org that the hunters and trappers use there to monitor the ice. And there, you know, nobody knows better than the local indigenous people about how the ice develops, right?
Yeah.
So we've been working with them to do this. But even this was news. They knew it was a bad area, but they didn't know that it melted this fast, right? And it's because, I don't know how nerdy you are about this, because I'm pretty nerdy, but if you ever heard of the Franklin Expedition, which was an English expedition that was trying to find the Northwest Passage, 129 men disappeared in the late 1840s, never found. Many expeditions went to find them. The desk in the Oval Office is built from one of the ships that went to find them.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that like, forgive me, but isn't this part of the movie National Treasure?
I don't know.
Was the boat called the Charlotte?
No.
Okay.
No.
The secret lies with Charlotte.
Erebus and Terror were the two boats that were lost in the north. Anyway. They were beset by ice, like about, I'm talking 20 kilometers from where we went in. So this is for Canadians, too. This is like a Northwest Passage story. And what happens is this
like
is actually
our Donner Party shit.
Yeah, sort of. this is the southernmost Northwest Passage. So there's a little break in the Boothia Peninsula. You can look it up on a map, where basically the Atlantic Ocean flows into the Arctic Ocean, and then that current turns south, and it's right underneath what's called the Tasmanian Islands, where we sunk in. So they get on. They go over the other track. They find there's ice all around. They wait. They decide to wait out the night. But it's minus 28. They don't want to close the doors because this vehicle could fall through the ice. But they don't want to open them because there's polar bears everywhere. And so they.
And it's minus 28.
Yeah. And so these guys they don't seem to have PTSD, but they've.
Yeah, your truck has just gone through the ice, right. And you're now still on the ice.
Yeah. So in the morning, they get up, unloaded everything from the truck, and inched it. So they found that straight ahead was open water. All around the rest of the way was very thin ice. There was a good path to an island about 100 yards away. So they inched it over to the island, got it up on the island, carried all the other stuff over. The indigenous guide found that they'd been circled by polar bears, and indeed they spotted the two polar bears that had been circling them all night, hunting
them.
Holy shit. Got up there, and then we got a chopper in to get them out.
With or without the truck? I know it's secondary to people.
But. So this is the part of the story. So they left the truck on the island with the trailer. We turned the amphibious vehicles around and came down. It was 3 days away from us. We came down with the amphibious vehicles and drove that truck off the island. So got it out down to a southern community and then shipped it with the power boost, the hybrid, down to Montreal, came back. We went back in August this year and got the other truck out, which was unbelievable.
What do you mean? Like the one that was underwater?
Yeah. We want to do the right thing by the environment. We want to do the right thing for everybody. It's an indigenous lands, right? So we got a Super Puma helicopter staged up. It's a firefighting helicopter from southern BC. We staged it up to the Arctic, which is not nothing to get a helicopter like that up there. Okay, huge helicopter. We staged ourselves up. We set up a camp on this island. An incredible experience for me because we found, for example, tents are, and by this time I'd hired four local indigenous Inuit folks, two of whom ran the underwater ROV camera, and two guides because the polar bears are still there in the summer. They don't hibernate. And we went to this island that, we called uninhabited. It's got a number in the Canadian government nomenclature. But we found tent circles on the island and meat caches. And even the indigenous guys were like, oh, my gosh, these are really old. These are 1,000 years old because look how small they are compared to us. Like, it was unbelievable culturally. Oh. Anyway, we brought basically special forces ice divers in. Dove in a 5-mile-an-hour current. We took up inflatable boats.
This all sounds very inexpensive.
I mean, you call up. You can look up Transglobal Car Expedition. You can look up all these videos online. We shot them.
Do you want that data?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. So anyway, we went a 5-mile-an-hour current. The divers went down, attached airbags to it, lifted it up. It had rolled upside down, moved a little bit from where we geopinned it before. Oh, there's also a great video. When we went back down and got the other truck off the island, we dug a hole in the ice. And I plopped a GoPro down through, and there's like I'm standing. It's like minus 30, and I'm like, there's frost on my beard, and I'm like, the risk of an expedition is that things can happen. And put it through a hole in the ice, and psh, you just see a bright blue truck on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean.
Is that video online, or is it?
I can share that one with you. Okay. I posted that one. So we floated it, dragged it close to shore, put it down, rolled it over their bags, winched it up on shore, then brought the helicopter back. Helicopter had never lifted 8,300 odd pounds wet, but we lifted it, flew it down to the lower community, and then shipped it back down, and it's now back in Montreal. So anyway, we got
anything salvageable from that?
No,
truck?
No, it's totally not. I mean, it still looks like a truck, but all of the aluminum, all of the composite, everything is salted out.
It was under there for a while.
Six months off.
Yeah, that's a while.
But we looked at all the reservoirs, and it looks like it lost like about 2.5 liters of fluid, which was what we really wanted to figure out, right? Because we didn't want to contaminate the environment.
Yeah.
So, but it was for me. Again,
2.5 liters is like not that much. I mean, it's obviously you want it as close to zero as possible, but
you're
it's not the fucking
right.
Passing freighters are shedding know. So we don't feel too bad about it, but again, we want to do the right thing by the local communities, their land. So we want to make sure that we're welcome next year and just do the right thing. So anyway, it's been a great voyage, and this has all been through the Arctic Truck's sort of window and my expedition plan window. And so I'm going back. we're going back in about 3 weeks. I go back to test going across, and this is the gnarliest thing. Using these amphibious vehicles you called up to go across what we call open leads. Because what happens is as the ice breaks, it comes apart. And the reason that people don't go to the geographic North Pole is that it's mostly open water now, right? Oh. With like ice flows moving around. So you have to be able to go off the ice flows and back onto the ice flows. So what we're going up to do now is literally to drop these vehicles in the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah. You are out of your mind. This is awesome. One of the craziest stories I've ever heard. Like I'm torn between going, hey, you want to volunteer to go and I'll use GoPros and film you guys? And also like, I don't want to die.
Yeah.
Well, wow. He asked me to go, or for part of it,
yeah.
And I couldn't go because of some other road and track thing that I had to do. I don't remember what it was, but it was like a direct conflict, but it would have been possible to like be on part of that.
In fact, if you had been able to do that, it's possible you would have been in that southern bound group that went through the ice. So we might not be having this conversation today.
Yeah, sweet.
Holy shit.
I mean, when I drove the Sherp, it was in northern Minnesota.
Yeah.
And we went to a frozen lake and we found an area where the ice was thin and we intentionally drove it through the ice and then we're just like driving it around as a boat.
Yeah,
And it was fucking badass. It was the coolest thing ever. And yeah. I was like, yeah, if we had one of these, like, be all right. Yeah. Like, it was cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I mean, it's intimidating. It's a bit specialized. You don't go to driving school for this. But these vehicles have ways to winch up on the ice. It's hard. It's hard getting back up on the ice once you're down in it. But that's where we're going to make sure that 11 of us are going up to train.
That's pretty cool.
Hmm.
So
that's nuts.
When do they think they'll be able to sell vehicles in the U.S.?
So if you told me today that you really needed a retail Arctic truck and we talked about the spec, I don't want to promise anything, but you know, we'd be looking at deliveries early 2024.
Oh, okay.
We have this sort of pent up commercial demand.
What do they use them for? Like you keep saying mines. Is it gravel, snow? What is it purpose?
Northern Canadian oil and diamond and so on, like prospecting up there.
Yeah.
Where they use tracked vehicles and they use Sherps and other things. But Sherps are very small. They don't really have any luggage capacity or carrying capacity, whereas we have a 6x6 with a flat deck, mm-hmm. right? Or some of the prospecting is done with snowmobiles, which is at risk. You're out in the elements and there are bears in that area also. So and we're looking at other applications too that are not necessarily all snow based with the mines. So there's that. There's a lot of applications. It's expanding very quickly. But what I'm curious to unlock, because we kind of know those applications, but what would be the sweet spot in America for the retail market? Because honestly, I'm not sure you want to drive around on 44-inch studded tires all the time, although we can do that for you.
Yeah.
They're actually DOT approved. But is there a 39 or 42-inch option in a Super Duty F-150 Tacoma Tundra that would fit the appetite for people who want extreme snow capability and probably sand capability along with it?
Yeah.
That's what we need to figure out.
Yeah.
So feel free to bring on your comments.
Well, I think they're really cool. They're obviously highly specialized, and they're not for everybody. But when I saw Top Gear, and then when I went to Iceland and saw what they were doing with them over there, I was like, how is America not all over this? It just seems like the kind of thing that ridiculous Americans would want.
Well, is it something where
exactly?
are they just not great at like highway driving, rock crawling? Are they not optimal for rock crawling? They can do it. Like I rode in one of these in Iceland because I crossed the middle of the island with for the TV show we were doing.
Remember that guy from Arctic Trucks was wearing fucking Tevas?
Oh yeah, yeah. He had socks on.
He had socks and Tevas driving across the glacier.
His name was Arnard.
He was
awesome. He was awesome.
I mean, they're tough. They're tough guys.
The dumbest people in the world. Because we were doing a lot of really stupid stuff. We got a raptor stuck, and he's like, and he tows us out. Yeah. But so we were going over the lava rocks there, and we were going over the sand. It was July. And we went over a little bit of snow and they were fine. But is this something where they're not optimal for what a lot of our American off-road community is into, and they're more for people that are just sand or just interested in snow?
So that's an excellent question. Look, the 44-inch tires that you see on most of the expedition vehicles when you look at the site are not really optimized for that kind of use because they don't have the sidewall resilience that you're going to want for that, especially when they're aired down. However, as I said, we're working with BFG, and I'm a big old BFG nerd, that have tires that are very robust in the sidewall. So the answer is watch this space. I think that these vehicles, subject to ground clearance, could do a lot of what any off-road vehicle does in America. We just don't lift them, mm-hmm. or minimally. right? And that's the jam. So, and the other thing is, I got to say, I was driving the 44-inch around Detroit in December, which is pretty funny.
Was the ride excellent?
Yeah, it was actually pretty good. Yeah, I aired down a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing to see the response you get. But even the 44-inch at you know, 60 miles an hour is actually okay. But you probably don't want to daily it, right? But our 39, 42-inch options or something in that range?
Yeah.
I think we could do.
I'm very vocal about driving things that are so big they inconvenience others.
100%.
And so I don't think people should buy these things just to fuck around with on the street. I don't think you'd enjoy what you got, and I think you'd be a nuisance to everybody else most of the time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, the, you know, sports cars, as you well know, are now so fast, and we're driving them on roads that were designed 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, the desert is one of the few places that's left where you can really go play. And it's culturally acceptable to go play in the desert. There are no speed limits in the desert. You know, there's places where certainly that are protected environmentally, but there's other places where it's okay to, like, run shit over and rocks and whatever. And so given that shift has happened in car enthusiasm, whether it's Razors or trophy type of trucks or side-by-sides or whatever, it seems like there's the upside-down truck underwater.
Yeah, that's why I took that picture.
Fuck me.
Yeah.
But, you know, given that is now where we're at as enthusiasts, it just seemed like such a no-brainer. And that they look so silly in a good way. You know, the proportions of them are so different from a trophy truck or a Brodozer or a Super Duty.
Yeah.
You look at it and you go, oh, I don't know what I'm looking at, but it looks cool as fuck. You know,
yeah.
So I'm just so into the way that they look stylistically.
Yeah.
And it's for a function.
And that's what I love most about it, is that it's like, it's only driven by authenticity. There's never been, and I'm now involved in all the design calls and things, and it's cool.
Yeah.
They're like, it's only like, does this thing work better? Is it going to cover the fenders better? Is it going to be more robust?
Well,
is it going to be
Icelandic people don't do anything for style.
I know. Yeah.
That is a country that is 100% functional.
Yeah.
Everything.
But that's the beauty of it, you know? And then that's why I'm proud to be associated with the brand and really, really happy that we could bring it to the U.S. because it's a beautiful vehicle. It's funny, I've never heard it described that way, but you're right, it's a beautiful vehicle. But for me, because it's driven by the function.
Yeah, no, but you could if you look at one and you're a car enthusiast, it makes you smile because the proportions are so silly, but in this kind of friendly way.
Well, it's kind of like a daily driven monster truck. Like, you know, the real monster trucks have these huge balloon tires. You never see those anywhere else. And so this has huge balloon tires with giant sidewall, and they're super wide and super fenders. But then in the middle between it is like a normal cab.
Yeah.
And a normal actual truck. So, I mean, aesthetically, they look awesome. And then they can just do so much.
Yeah. Well, that power boost that I have in Detroit will be coming out to the West later in the spring. If you want to drive it, you let me know.
I would love to.
Yeah.
Is in America, is it going to be F-150 only at first? Or
no, we're mostly right now building Super Duties.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, the F-150, we'll see what the demand is. We've had some interest from like search and rescue and so on who aren't going out and they're not carrying a lot of stuff. They're just trying to get into a place and get back out. The F-150 maybe is good for. Vehicle supply is a real problem for us also. And we're also now, I've just reached out to some of my old people, you probably know, friends at Toyota and so on, saying, hey, you know what? Maybe we should be thinking about some of your platforms too. Because that's historically, Arctic Trax has done a lot with Hiluxes, especially in Antarctica.
Yeah.
And so I think that despite the fact that we can't have them here exactly, I think that there's something in that form factor that could work.
I haven't been in a Hilux recently. How close is the relationship between a Hilux and a Tacoma today?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question in 2024, and I don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah.
My understanding is that there may be more crossover going forward, and that would be helpful.
And you said BFG makes the tires for these things?
Well, so those 44-inch you see there are Nokian tires. And in fact, that's co-developed with Arctic Trax over the years.
Who else would use that?
Yeah, because Nokian's perfect.
Is that like a 16 or like a 15?
It's on a 17.
That's a 17-inch rim?
Yeah, but it's a 44-inch tire. Yeah,
<That's>
exactly.
Crazy.
It looks like a little.
Too,
yeah, like that's like the same size wheel
wide.
As a Raptor.
15-inch wide wheel?
Yeah, 17 by 15.
Wow.
Yeah. it's a cool wheel. It's a fairly expensive wheel. And actually, I'm talking to some of my friends in the U.S. We're going to look at manufacturing them here too.
Bro, Rotiform.
Watch this space.
1552 Turbo Max.
Watch this space. Yeah, and we're going to get some other options besides. So there's beadlock, non-beadlock options. We want to build an alloy. We want to build a three-piece. So, but again, it's always going to follow function.
Sure,
we're not going to be a designy place.
You're
it's
not
going to be
something. Put it on rims.
It's yeah,
not
right.
Be like, can I get it? Can I get it in chromes?
Yeah.
Can I get it in blue chrome?
Now you're going to have a 44-inch tire and a 40-inch rim. Is really going to be the yes. thing in LA. That's a Nokian tire. But I'll tell you what's been really interesting to me. BFG sponsored me for years, and I became a brand ambassador. And they have really leaned into this relationship. We have a great dialogue with their engineers, with the business principals there. They really want to make a solution. They don't have an out of the box solution that's perfect for this, but we're already working on what may be the right thing. And what I love is that, when you think of the BFG tires, the KM3 or the KO2, the KO2 is winter competent, three peak mountain snowflake and all that. But we're now saying, okay, so how competent is it at minus 40? Let's figure that out. And they're like, yeah, let's figure that out.
And of course, you're in the business of selling, mounting, and balancing tires with Zip Tire, which I use here at the shop all the time, and I fucking love Zip Tire.
Thank you.
Tire shop in a truck. They come to you.
Thank you.
ZipTire.com.
Yeah. Is it ZipTire.com? ZipTire.net.
Sorry.
ZipTire.com is a shop in Virginia. We've been trying to get the URL. We will.
Probably.
But ZipTire.net.
Yep.
And we're Zip happy to service you. And you. We've serviced your M3.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you showed up.
Yeah, I showed up. I showed up that time. Oh, it was you. I saw Zach coughing. Yeah. I'm going to jump in a truck and go get him.
Yeah, and then you showed up. I was like, oh, shit, what's up, man?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I did that to surprise you.
How do you mount and balance a fucking 44-inch tire?
Yeah. And with lots of work. It's not the traditional way. You can use just tire irons, actually, like you can use with a semi-truck on the side of the road. And the beadlock actually helps you there. Because, of course, the outer bead then is easier to work.
Yeah.
And because you have so much, it's such a rubbery big balloon, you can actually work it pretty easily.
Oh, okay.
So but balancing it.
That's a
balancing it's another thing. Because suddenly you've got this mass at 44 inches, and you can only put the weight at the 17-inch mark. So, honestly, for the speeds they go, often you don't really need to balance them. But, for example, the power boost we have in Detroit is balanced, and it's like there's just, weights around half the wheel, which personally, as a tire shop owner, makes me extremely
nerdy.
And
you probably have can see them really easy too, right? Because
totally.
They're just right there. Oh, that would drive me insane. But I guess what are you going to do?
Yeah.
That's fucking crazy. That's at your SEMA booth. Mm-hmm. I'd have a guy mounting and, because they have that in the industrial section
right.
of SEMA.
Apex.
They've got the guy upstairs who's just mounting and unmounting the tire all day. That would be a good job for that guy. There.
Yeah, I guess. No, we plan to have probably what will be one of our retail products at SEMA, and then we'll probably bring one of the 6x6 big gnarly trucks just to show it off.
That's all that's going to fit in a booth.
I know.
So why your truck's so wide? Why do we got room for two?
The 6x6 is so sexy, honestly. It's so massive, and the flotation tires, you take those down to 3 PSI, and it's just like something from the moon.
The vans, I really like the vans too. So for some reason, those vans look really, really cool with the treatment.
Oh, yeah. And that's, again, watch this space. It's going to be a little bit figuring out what demand is in the U.S.
Why did you say it was so hard to build Sprinters? What is it about a Sprinter that makes it hard to build?
Sprinters and Transits. It's F-150s are body on frame, right?
Oh,
F-3s are body on frame, right? And you can achieve a lot. The truth is we carve out a lot of a front of an F-150 to fit a tire underneath.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that easy on a unibody. So,
yeah, but it looks so fucking cool when it's a Sprinter.
It looks gnarly,
Does a ladder have to come down? Probably
no, well, that's the thing. It's still relatively low. It's like Raptor height from the ground. It's not Brodozer height.
Yeah.
Right? And that's part of the charm of it, too. It's
so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited. I'm excited to give you the scoop.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to get these to the market because I think that people will love this shit out of
them. They're really, really cool. I really need to have a go in the hybrid one.
That'd yeah, well, cool. I want to get you on the snow with it. I mean, you've been in Iceland, so I guess you know, but it's really, once you've gone...
We'll be there in July.
Yeah.
And there was snow and the Raptor got stuck, but there was, I think the only snow we drove on was honestly 500 feet long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you couldn't come last year to the Arctic Ocean, but when you're going across ice blocks the size of buildings, navigating the Arctic Ocean, you're like, wow, we're out there.
Yeah, that's a different thing.
Yeah. Our guide was saying in the winter, they would just, during Northern Lights, they would just drive up a glacier at nighttime, him and two friends.
Yeah.
And that's how they practice, being these volunteer search and rescue and being guides. But because they have the skills, he's like, and he showed me his personal truck that he built, which was Arctic truck equipped Tacoma. Mm. And he's like, yeah, we just drive up the side of the glacier and watch the stars and then come back down.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. All the world experts of this are in Iceland. Mm-hmm. And by extension, there are people. So we're bringing that story here.
Cool.
Those guys are fucking great. I need to go back there and go to 60 below too. 66 degrees north.
Yeah.
Best winter gear ever.
Oh yeah, it is good. And
that
we actually
rules.
We have a lot of their gear.
Do you?
Yeah.
God, the fucking fleece I bought from them was epic. Such a great piece of gear.
We have some interesting relationships with Trans Global Car Expedition, which you should look up too. Which is this around the world expedition through both poles next year,
mm-hmm.
Because we work with Red Fox and some other really exotic. Because a lot of the guys on the team are like. The founder of the team, a very interesting guy, has like summited all the top seven, you know, the seven sisters. And one of the guys is a former Soviet mountaineer, Olympic mountaineer. That's Vasily Alagin. This is our expedition. Then one of the guys is the president of the Seven Summits Club. Like these are all extreme mountaineers. And so mm-hmm. They're like, Andrew, here's your gear. Here's cold weather gear. I'm like,
That's
super exotic.
Yeah,
stuff you've never heard of, but they're like, no, this is what works.
Yeah. He gave me a balaclava, like, this keeps you warm. I'm like, oh my God, it's built out of like a molybdenum or something. There's us lifting the truck with the helicopter.
Oh yeah, that's getting the truck out. Look at that.
Yeah.
That's fucking so cool. I wouldn't want to park one at the mall next to somebody else, but those F-150s do look pretty badass.
Yeah, and they are. There are. We love them. And the expedition is going to be really exciting. Where the stated goal with Good Gear is to bring technologies to communities around the world. We're working with the ICE data in the north to help them get more accurate ICE data and make sure the imagery from the satellite imagery is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not, frankly, it isn't always. There's a lot of slush in the system. But we're
no pun intended.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And that's the other thing. Like, you know, this like Smilla sense of snow. There's like the Inuit have like 60 different words for snow, right?
Mm.
And even the ice, there's slush ice, there's salt. What happens actually is there are fissures in the ice, and then the salt comes up, and then that softens the ice because it lowers the freezing point.
Yeah.
And then you get in this like slushy. It's like minus 30, but you're in slushy ice because
because
the ocean is percolating through. It's very interesting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, and because I'm a tire nerd, this all appeals to me too.
When you guys would, on this expedition, would you just stop on the ice, that's where you camp for the night, and then you just keep going? Like, how long was it, what was the longest stretch between land? You know, when you left, like, underneath there's actual terra firma and you were on ice for a while.
I don't know if you can see a map. I mean, we did probably fully 1,500 kilometers straight on the ocean. Yeah. Now, between islands, because it's actually... It depends. It's usually easier to go over the ocean than over the islands because you don't know what the terrain is underneath, to your point. But we have to use very accurate imagery because the ice isn't smooth. It's not a billiard table. What happens is the tides pull up the water underneath. It cracks it puts cracks in the ice, and then those refreeze and push together. So you get these huge, you know, piles.
Yeah, the crack. I remember that from the Top Gear thing.
Yeah.
That was a bunch of that.
Yeah. So that's the hardest thing to do is negotiate all those. So we use very accurate, and we've worked to have communications back and forth. We have a very expensive satellite dish, which I just bought something from Elon Musk. I just bought two Starlinks.
Yeah. They work?
They just arrived in my front porch in Las Vegas this week. I'm going to take them up to the Arctic next week. But we really have to get a lot of imagery to us every day because this changes every day,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we've tried to find ways to make smaller packets of data so that we can see where we're going all the time. But we have to negotiate around all these broken ice bits.
Did it involve a lot of shoveling?
Less than you might think. We carry shovels. We carry special snatch cables. We have an incredible type of ice pick that breaks through the ice. You can break up a huge ice block with the right blow. But you don't want to shovel it out if you can avoid it. The big secret I will tell all of your listeners and you, if you ever start to get stuck in snow, don't mash the throttle. You never spin the wheels.
Oh.
That's the real thing. Right.
You
just rock back and forth, compress the snow, and move out. Once you spin, you're done.
Because you turn the snow into water and ice.
You just throw it out from under you, and then you're on the frame.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
It's so easy to throw away. You just have to compress it, compact it in order to crawl up on it.
Mm. Interesting. It
takes a calm mind.
I feel like I've heard that before. I forget where I might have learned that, but I feel
sand,
like
similar to sand.
That's probably true. Yeah. Yeah, when we were in Morocco with the Dakar, they made a real big deal. I'm like, don't slam on the brakes, don't slam on the gas, unless you're already going really fast.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I ask, so how did you get to this? Like, I know you from rally racing a little bit, and then, you know, you produced Hyperdrive, created it. Like, so which to me, I was also going to ask about that leap. But now I didn't even know about this side of you, and this is insane. So, like, how did you go from you were like an FD driver and a rally driver and here?
Oh, thanks.
Tires.
Well, it's all about tires. Zip tire. It's an interesting question. So I think I just like challenges with cars, and I just have looked for new ones. So I love rally racing so much. It's my lifelong passion, rally racing. And I had a good run. You know, I drove from Mitsubishi and then Ford, and we did well, and we won some stuff, and I loved it, loved it. But you can't do it all your life, especially in America. It's not a career. And I eventually I was driving for Ford at the end with B.F. Goodrich. It was a great deal. We won stuff, and then I just sort of had to move on. And then I was like, what's the next most logical, hard thing? And I started pitching this pole-to-pole expedition. And I didn't get mine over the line, but then somebody from Switzerland who's like, yes, we're going to do the round-the-world expedition. Will you join us? I'm like, okay. And that's how this Transglobal has evolved, and I've gotten together with them. And it's an international – I say it's kind of like an English patient thing. There's guys from Russia, the Ukraine, Germany, Scotland, Iceland. I've got a couple of my old rally mechanics or some of the mechanics on it now, and me as a Canadian. And that's what I love about it. It's very international. We were actually in the high Arctic when the conflict broke out last year between Russia and the Ukraine. And we had Russians and Ukrainians in the same vehicles together in the high Arctic.
Jeez.
And but none of it matters, right?
Of course, right. Anyway, it's like space, like the folks at the space station don't care about,
Exactly. But anyway, to answer your question, this isn't my therapy session, but I grew up on a farm in Canada, and like I rolled my first pickup truck at age 7 and just drove dune buggies and dirt bikes and snowmobiles. So turns out I think the thing that I'm probably best at is just messing around with cars, and this is the logical extension of messing around with cars.
Logical.
Yeah.
You've done everything. So you're like, well, what's left? And then soon you'll drive to space.
You gotta revert. You gotta go to like drive the Model T across the country without roads or something like that.
But that's what drew me to the Model T, actually. The reason I have one, and we use it around LA with my kids, and I put car seats in the back, it's because like it's different, and I want another chance. I wanted to learn how to drive a different vehicle.
Yeah, right? They're very different.
Have you driven one?
A bunch.
Oh, yeah.
I drove a bunch.
Yeah, so, and once you, now I've got it. For the first 6 months, it was, like, more terrifying than driving, like, a new S90 or something.
Yeah.
It's like, because it's like, am I pressing the right pedal? I don't even know. Is this the brake? And I just love challenges.
There, if you can drive a Model T without a bunch of cars around, it makes perfect sense.
Right.
Because the throttle's like cruise control, and so if you can see something coming from 30 seconds away, you have plenty of time to make adjustments, and you're really just steering, and it's just going.
Yeah.
But my buddy John Bothwell, the Persang dude, has like 6 or 7 Model Ts, and so I drove the stock one. I drove the what he called the Super T, which is the most capable off-road Model T possible using period available parts.
Interesting.
So it's got
a half track or it's a
no. It's not a half track. It's got wheels. Okay. But Zach, can you pull up the Road and Track story? Just put Road and Track Matt Farah Model T, and we'll have pictures of it because I did it for Road and Track. But it's got like a Ruckstall transfer case. It's got a water pump.
Right.
It's got some kind of cool cylinder head. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Well, Model Ts, as you can see there, I mean, they have a 1080 flex ratio. You got to be a Road and Track member. You're behind the paywall.
We should probably subscribe here.
You should probably. You can come on.
We should probably
subscribe to read your articles, so you can use my.
I have a subscription too, but I'm not going to be like Zach. The password. Yeah.
After.
But the flex ratio is like 1080.
Yeah.
Right. And
it had, this one had wire wheels, which were only available in the very last year, and then this one that's blurred out there was the other one, which is the Speedster.
Oh, yeah, those are cool.
Which he turned into a race car.
Yeah.
And that one was different because it had a gas pedal.
Right.
You can modify
that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. One was more like a regular car.
I've got a Ruckstall. Mine came with a Ruckstall and Rocky Mountain brakes.
The Super T also had Rocky Mountain brakes.
And that makes it livable.
Rear drums.
Yeah, because otherwise your entire braking system is a band on the tail shaft of the transmission.
It doesn't do anything.
Yeah, and if you have a Ruckstall, even worse, it can get locked between high and low ratio.
Yeah.
And then you have no brakes.
Yeah.
At all,
yeah.
Which is, the thing's terrifying enough already. I have to carry my 7 and 9 year old daughters around in the back, so I got to make it safe.
But it's,
I got to get Rocky Mountain.
It's break. I feel like it's an experience that like everybody should have driving one of those things. And when John came, when he came with us on our off road trip with his stock Model T, and then he went and built the Super T. Like I took the Super T off roading, and it was amazingly capable.
You know why? Because roads back then,
yeah,
were off roading.
That was it.
Yeah.
And it was so easy and nice to drive off-road, and it was so capable and, like, didn't get hot. It didn't have a, it didn't have any problems with anything. It was so great.
Yeah.
So like,
yeah, it'd be a great vehicle. I took the, I, mine came with a water pump. I took it off because I wanted to learn the joys of thermosiphon, right? So water gets hot, goes to the top, it goes in the radiator, gets cool, falls down. I mean, Henry Ford was an engineering genius.
Yeah, I mean, it was the simplicity for the time, but when you start using it in the modern world, having a little extra is not so
bad. We go pick up the Christmas tree with it every year, and everyone loves it. You know what? I've got a few good old cars like you do, and you drive those around, and maybe you feel cool, but most people think you're kind of a D-bag or whatever. The Model T, I'm going to say you're always cool. But the Model T makes everybody happy.
It's a different thing, right? Yeah, for sure.
Like everybody, because you're driving a museum piece.
Except the people that are stuck behind you in traffic.
Yeah,
they're annoyed.
Fair enough. Yeah. But we've actually brought the Christmas tree home with the kids in the car seats in the back, my wife beside me, the tree jammed in between us, and people like stop walking and clap.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's that much fun. We have the Auga horn, the train whistle on the exhaust. I love that thing.
The Auga horn,
And it cost me like $8,000. I put like $4,000 into it. It's my cheapest, funnest car.
Do you work on it yourself?
Yeah. It's my therapy. I go and fettle with stuff. I get less and less time with all these things going on, but I do. And that's been fascinating too. I learned stuff like the bottom pulley for the fan belt doesn't have any edges to it, and my fan belt kept falling off. Right? I'm like, what a stupid design! It doesn't have any edges to it. And so I replaced. You can get a modern replacement that has an aluminum machine piece that has edges to it.
Yeah.
And it's because the whole thing isn't quite lined up right. It's because of the vehicle being old. But it turns out I had to learn that there's a little crown to the bottom pulley for the fan belt. And I hadn't thought of this. Under tension, something that's slightly crowned will hold the fan belt on because it's pushing in both directions with the stretch,
sure.
Right? It's like, it's simple, it's elegant, and it reminds me to learn something every day. I have that pulley actually on my desk in my office. I'm like, just learn something today. Because I know a fair bit about cars. I learn something from the Model T. It teaches me stuff all the time.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
I like that car a lot. It's just it's a very charming thing.
Yeah.
It took me a while to get used to the Model T. I hated it the first time I drove it. I was like, thank God this isn't
the thing. You know what they said in the day? Better than walking.
Yeah. And if you had no other car experience, it actually wouldn't be that hard at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah, it was said to be easy to drive by ladies because of the pedal thing. No gear shift. It's a great unit. Anyway, and
handle moving a lever.
Right. Again, because I'm a tire nerd, zip tire. I like mounting the tires because it's like bicycle tires. You have to like use levers to – and
oh, yeah.
I'll tell you this.
That's tubes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not only that, but I think that it's the source of ambiguity between rims and wheels because people use those words interchangeably. Right?
Sure.
Model Ts, the later Model Ts anyway, have demountable steel rims on wooden wheels.
Okay? So that's
wheel,
a rim.
Right. The rim holds the tire.
The wheel is the spokes.
Exactly. And you bolt the rim onto the wheel.
You have wire wheels though, right? Not wood wheels. You have wood wheels?
In fact, I need to get them rebuilt because they're going clackety-clack. There are a couple guys left in the country. I need to send them out to a wheelwright.
Why are they going clackety-clack?
Because the spokes are loose. They dry.
Wood wheels,
they dry
dude.
Out. Yeah.
They dry out and shrink, right?
But there are still a couple of guys for not very much money.
You get some oil at Home Depot? Get some varnish.
You soak them. No, dude, what you do is you soak them for so long, and then you have to get them rebuilt.
Bro, just bring them to the crib, throw them in the pool.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Yeah.
Doesn't Sherwin-Williams have like a deck sealant that you can use?
Maybe. But the other thing I love is that like all of the real enthusiasts, I'm like, I don't know if I'm the youngest, but I'm one of the younger people who own a Model T because all the other guys are like octogenarians in the Midwest.
I will argue that point because there is a resurgence actually, 100%. And I've seen a couple different examples. The guy John Bothwell, who's my friend who has him, the dude who comes with him to work on his on his car is like 22.
Yeah, 100%.
And there's a club in Newport which I met when I was up there at the Audrain of people under 30 that are enthusiasts of Model Ts and Model As.
Right.
Because they're so cheap.
Yeah.
There's
so many.
And young. Some of these young folks are looking for like a community. You know, that isn't necessarily like drifting or whatever.
Yep.
It's kind of their ticket into this sort of what is actually in Newport particularly a kind of high society level community, but with a cheap car. Because it's like if you've got the Model T and this dude's got a Packard, like you can hang out together because the car's so fucking old. It's like the same thing.
Bruce Meyer came over to my house for another unrelated reason, and he was like, he was pouring all over the Model T. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, why don't you bring it out to my Beverly Hills show?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
It would be perfect for the annual I Own the Police Father's Day drive.
That's a great show. I love that one.
There, yeah. He invited me. He really sold me on that one. He goes, you got to bring the Countach out. I shut down all the traffic lights going across town, which is true, but is a highly selective statement. Because, yes, the traffic lights are shut down, .. so we can drive 5 miles an hour the whole way across town like a parade.
Yeah.
My clutch was unhappy with me.
Oh, well, I'm sure in that
but
car.
But in a Model T, you just put it in L and you're good to fucking go.
And you can take out your
phone. No hands, baby.
Like, what? We were taking a picture once at Rennsport reunion, and there was like, you know, 60 race cars.
Yeah.
And we're going around at 12 miles per hour. All the cars are mad. And then I think Pat Long and someone else we knew just passed us, and they were like, the car's going to overheat.
Yeah.
And they just they're like, fuck your picture.
I was right there. But I was following Jeff Dunham, who was driving the Lost in Space, like, moon buggy thing.
Oh,
which
right.
I was like, all right, well, this is a novelty. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Model T is great. Everybody loves it, and it is an inroad to a different car culture. But anyway, my point of the story is that if you want, like, if you want your coil box rebuilt, which is, you know, like, because, you know, it's got four individual coils, it's the equivalent of coil on plug, like modern cars generally are, or some are. Either you have these individual four coil boxes that are constantly buzzing, and it's a hit and miss system, right? But if you need that thing rebuilt, you can buy them, but they're expensive. You need it rebuilt, you like mail it to a guy in Kansas.
Sounds right.
And he inspects it, and then he tells you how much it's going to cost. Then you mail him a check. Okay, and he's somewhere between 80 and 300 years old.
Yeah,
and you can expect it back within a few weeks. Like that.
Does he tell you his phone number is like KL423?
Yeah. It's seven digits for sure. He doesn't think of the area code.
Yeah, that's fucking crazy. I love those cars though. They're great. That makes sense. I hope they pass on enough knowledge that people can make a business case for. You know, fix
yeah,
them.
Maybe.
It
maybe.
Seems like you get some of what you get from owning like an old motorcycle. Like you can tinker with it.
For
it's
sure.
kind of simple and small, but you don't have to ride a motorcycle.
But this leads into, well, I wanted to ask you guys what you think, because I have a desert island car, like a car. If only I could have one car. It's not a Model T.
Okay.
But but if you think in that design language, you might get it.
Wait. You want us to guess? Like if you had one car on a desert island?
Yeah. I'm very sensitive to not asking you the wrong question. Now that I've listened to your recent podcast, I want to make sure
I ask
the right question.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask it. If I could only
either
have...
create a fantasy or ask
right.
me something in reality.
Right.
Don't ask
okay.
me a fantastical
okay.
question that's meant to actually be reality.
I don't want to mess this up then, because I want to make sure I ask it correctly. But like, if I could only have one car, what would it be?
Oh,
don't phrase it wrong. Don't make him mad.
Yeah, don't make me mad. Fuckers.
Get under the desk.
Would it be...
Now, are you saying you have to have it on a desert island or one car?
No, that's why the desert island is a total disaster, because there's no reason to have it.
Would it be like the Thomas Crown Affair Shelby that like Richard Rawlings has, which was like a Shelby Mustang safari car?
That's interesting, no. But it's an interesting idea. No.
Is it a stock car or modified?
Yeah, stock.
Okay.
Good question.
Is it a Beetle?
Oh, that's a good guess, but no.
Or Corvair. Why do I feel like it's air-cooled?
Why?
Because I just went down, my brain just went air-cooled for some reason.
Yeah, but your mechanical simplicity, you're going down the right road.
Lotus 7.
Ooh, I like those, but I'm pretty big for them.
You're too big for them,
yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, they're gnarly, and you'll die if you hit a valve stem.
Is it like old FJ?
Ah, old also good. I like those, but no. But although, you know what? Think FJ, old FJ, but older.
Willie's Jeep.
Older.
Oh, but not Model T.
Old, but not, and but like, it would have to be like something Model A, like a Model A.
Think Europe. I'm giving you too many clues.
Oh, Jesus.
Not a Volkswagen thing.
So like Hitler's 6x6 Mercedes?
Thing. I'll be really upset.
No, it's British.
Oh, Jesus. Where are we going
30s
with this?
British?
Come on. There's only
one. Blower Bentley?
Not even Blower. Bentley. WR.
Okay.
Right? Because you can drive that car every day. You can drive it. You can drive it in Los Angeles. You can drive it up to the hotel. You can drive it from Peking to Paris. That is the perfect car.
Right.
Sure.
It has off-road capability, right? It's incredibly robust. It's like a steam locomotive. You can rebuild it. You can fettle on it, right?
If you are driving one, you are the king of the universe
exactly.
at this point also.
Exactly.
I saw a fucking...
That's very good
that thing in Germany when that guy came to pick up Randy Nonnenberg... Randy from Bring a Trailer, we were at this conference in Germany, and it lets out, and we're at this idyllic resort on this lake. And everyone like leaves this convention hall and just cars are just fucking like a freight train up the hill. And there's this German dude with a big fucking curly mustache and a cigar and a bomber jacket and a scarf in a 6 liter 28 Bentley or something.
Yeah.
Randy's like, yeah, that's for me. And gets in this car and they tear ass up the mountain.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he just came to pick this guy up. It was fucking the G-est shit ever.
I ran into some Concours in London, England once, and there, it was all blower. It was all not blower. WO Bentleys, from the era, right? The original WOs, and all these old English chaps had them out and so on. It seemed fairly informal, and I happened to start chatting with one of the guys, and I said, you know, I had a young family or whatever. And I was like, I've always wanted to have one. Oh, you should have one. Yeah, it's been my family for 65 years. Yeah. It was all the time. All the kids ride. You must have one, man. I'm like, yeah, of course I must. They used to be only $300,000, and now they're like
$3 million.
Yeah, whatever they are.
Oh, you should get. I like. Yeah,
Brian Johnson from AC/DC's got one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, Bruce Meyer has one.
Yes, he does.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the perfect car. I want one.
I was just at his garage, and his one-upsmanship.
Yeah, yeah. You could probably trade your Countach for one. Probably about equal.
Yeah, but no.
I'm waiting for my 930 to get valuable enough.
Countach update. Donnie called me. I mean, Donnie had a very successful trip to London. Donnie has to physically go to Europe to get parts for these cars.
Oh, really?
And so he got some things for my car in London, as well as some Ferrari bits. He was freaking out when he called me because he found a new in-box original SKU Testarossa windshield. He was like freaking out about that.
Yeah.
So he's getting my suspension bits back together, and he's going to put the suspension back together, and then we have to take the whole fucking engine out.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Ouch. I get to go watch, though. I did say I wanted to go watch.
It's like, I don't know. It's like watching a porn scene or something. I'm not sure I want to see that happen.
I know. I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. But. I don't know. You have to tell me what you think the future of Zip Tire should be, because I'm trying to figure out what to do. You know, the tire industry is really so there's a lot more movement to mobile.
Yeah.
Because this is it's mobile, right?
Yeah.
We come to you, we service
you. It's the best.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. It's funny you should ask, Zach, you know what? I just retired from the rallying. And Michelin sent me a set of tires on my front porch, and I realized, oh, shit, I just shut down the shop. I'm going to have to take these tires down to some shop. And then I woke up the next morning thinking, oh, my God, I could just make a civilian van that does what all our rally vans have always done for years and give civilians the advantage of mobile tire installation, right?
Yeah.
I literally thought I was the first person to ever think of it. I called an executive I knew at Michelin. I said, I'm going to change the tire world. And she's Irish. Oh, yeah, Andrew, you know, a few boys have done that before. You should do a little research. And so I did. And I was on the road for Michelin at the time, so I invited all the tire van guys out, looked at all their vans, then built up our vans, right? Just by bought one, put it in my backyard, and built it up. And so we just sort of built it out that way, not thinking about, I never thought of an exit or like how the industry was going to go. But what's happened this year especially, because Discount Tire acquired Tire Rack, who acquired ASAP Tire, which was our only competitor in town in the day. So they're vertically integrated. Now another chain is starting to build mobile tire trucks. We have more experience in like an NP, like we have all 5-star reviews and people love us. So I got to figure out though how to partner with somebody or what to do.
I don't know about partnering.
We charge a consulting fee.
This is my business consulting.
Can you start a franchising business and allow people to have their own small businesses that are branded Zip Tire? And it's like Dave's Zip Tire, Mike's Zip Tire, and people can be their own boss.
I think that's a possibility because you know what really it relies on, and you know this because you've dealt with us for a long time, all of you guys, is it's kind of, you need to have somebody who really cares about the customers. It's always about, because your scheduling is so important, and we say we're going to be there between 9 and 11, we have to do that. We've pushed your envelope sometimes because you're a friend. That's the problem. You're my friend. So we're like, oh, we'll push Matt off a little bit because this other person.
Well, and usually, we're usually flexible because we have business hours. Sure. So if it's instead of 9, it's 1, it's not like the customer's standing there tapping his foot. That's usually a car that's in storage.
And we have to be alive to those people. But it's great when somebody really has their eye on the ball. So what I'm trying to do is build software systems to make it so that it's reliable enough to do what you say. I'm not sure if it's franchised, but so that somebody can press a button and know that the system is always going to work. I had a long call today with a couple of software developers about how we're going to try to make it and that all work. Because it has to be, you'll appreciate this. So the mobile service is one thing. We come to you, Zach, or we come to you here and do them here, right? But you guys don't need what most people need as the industry is changing, which is really good tire recommendations online.
Sure.
Right? And there are people in this space. Tire Rack is good, but we're all nerds and we can read their essays about tires, right? What you really need is a functionality where you can go and say, hey, I've got a E36 M3 or whatever. What tires are available and give me some recommendations? Because you get there's no, Tire Rack's a kind of reasonable one, but there's no really good tire selection algorithm. that allows you to get good recommendations for tires. And there's really very little data out there for what tires really are. You know that if you read about the Michelin Pilot Sport 4S, it's going to talk about aquaflume or grooves or whatever, right? Compounding. But most of the stuff that comes from the manufacturers is kind of honestly the same bump. It's all the same marketing speak.
It's like I send people to Grassroots Motorsports like all the time. Yeah. It's like for us, it's hard to test tires, like other than like this car has this and that car has that. But it's, we never are in a position where we test one car with four or five tires
right.
on it.
Well, you know, the GT I drove in today has a Michelin Cross Climate 2 on the front right and a Vredestein Quattrac Pro on the left front. Yeah, and all the tractions are disabled. So I go up in the snow and play with them and test them and stuff, right? Because we're nerdy, right? Like you come from racing, you get nerdy about tires.
Yeah.
And then we got in the tire industry. And so what I've realized is that part of our jam isn't just the mobile delivery. It's that we really want to give better recommendations to people when they're buying tires. Mm-hmm. The problem is I can't scale me up enough. So what I'm trying to do is build like a tire academy or a tire recommendation thing. There's also a bunch of old BF Goodrich guys who are basically retired with, you know, 50 years of tire experience, and I'm trying to rope them all in so that we can build a good tire database about why tires work.
Senior outreach program.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there it's an but you know, tires, there's over 200 moving parts in a tire. There's usually 404 different types of rubber. You know, have you been to like one of the Michelin plants or something?
Yeah, it's crazy.
They're complicated.
Yeah, it's really crazy.
Right? And they're all vulcanized into a black donut and then you don't know what's in there. Mm-hmm. Right? So you need people to explain that to you, and I want to do that because, you know, what in an old what tire experience is supposed to be? You're supposed to be able to go to a tire shop and talk to a guy behind the counter who really knows shit. Right? He says, what are you driving now? What kind of driving do you do? Hopefully he's a performance guy, you know, because people ask me all the time, a Cup 2 versus Pilot Sport 4S. When should I do this? And we know that because we do that stuff. But that guy almost doesn't exist at the tire store anymore. You know, I used to, for Michelin, train those guys. And some of them, there's some shops that are better than others. Some guys really do lean into it. But most of them are like, you need these Yokohamas because they're on the shelf behind me and I'm getting a $5 spiff this week, right?
Yeah.
And we're not those guys. So what I want to do is create an e-commerce experience where people get really good tire advice and we really put the right, you know, either just tell them the right tires to put on or hopefully also sell them the right tires to put on. And then augment that with the mobile installation experience. But I'm wondering if actually I've leaned in too much of the mobile installation, we should worry more about the front end.
Well, how do you make money on just the front end?
I think everybody needs that. I think even tire stores need that.
Oh, yeah. Well, if the resource is available to B2B and not just to customers directly also, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah,
because it's a hard one because I don't know that many people like that have so much experience with all those different tires and are able to make those recommendations from a real place of experience and education.
Right, and I assume that, you know, if you go to Tire Rack Shop or whatever, Discount Tire, like they type in your thing because they're trained to like install the thing. So they just type in, you have this car, you have these wheels, and it goes, well, this is what'll fit, these are the prices. And they do that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of up to the customer to maybe know. Maybe you ask the guys there and you say, well, I drive in the rain. And they go, well, this is better for that. That's better for that. So I guess, what are you trying to offer that might not provide, that doesn't provide?
I want to be wire cutter for tires.
Mm.
Got it.
In the first
tire
place.
Tire cutter.
See, it's I knew right I was there. Paying you for something. Oh, wait, I'm not paying you.
Tire cutter. You could be the thing. You could cut tires and actually show the cross sections of the.
I did that. Actually, we did that with a Michelin versus a Southeast Asian off-brand, and you can actually see the difference in the cords.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right?
I'm sure you
that's
can.
A good. I like that hook. But I think that's what we have to game now because we're not going to grow if we don't, you know, go more broadly or partner with somebody. So
yeah.
you guys have been in the Zip Tire experience for 5 years, pretty much as long as I have.
I just don't want you to go out of business because I need you to fucking do my tires for my customers and shit over here.
Okay. Well, our commitment will always be to our old friends.
If you do, just sell me the van.
Yeah. Right. Like, just park the van here.
Worst case, just park the fucking van.
Adam will drive it for drifting, and then you can keep it here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and thank you for your support. You've given us lots of good customers, too.
For sure. Do we have anything on the old Patreon? Couple? Let's get to the Patreon, of course, if you want to ask questions of our guests and of us, patreon.com/thesmokingtirepodcast. You can check out the live stream. You can ask questions that we'll answer on the air. You can get the show ahead of time, and you get the show ad-free. And let's see what we've got. Prashan says, can modern performance crossovers truly handle a rally stage, or is that just marketing?
That's an interesting
question.
It probably
can to a certain extent.
Well, you know, we did, one of my last gigs was driving for Scion, and we took an XD and made that into a rally car. And actually, we upgraded certain things, but it was pretty stock. And we did really, I mean, that car hauled, and we put a turbo on eventually. But, and Ryan Millen took a Toyota RAV4 and made very minimal modifications with an automatic transmission, or maybe a CVT,
yeah,
and actually did pretty good damage with it. So I think the answer is a qualified yes.
I think it probably could if you, as long as you didn't have like the 22-inch wheels, you put, yeah, you know, you put the right wheel and tire on there.
Man, we see, again, I don't want to come back to zip tire, but we see people with XC90s come home, or even mm-hmm. XC60s with like the 22-inch option or whatever. We've had guys driving home from the dealership crack two wheels. Like, if I could give your listeners any advice, get the little wheels.
Always get the little wheels. Yeah. My dad just got a new Cayenne, and he's like, which wheels should I get? I'm like, 19s.
The little wheels.
The little ones, yeah. Which I can't believe 19s are the little ones, but they are.
Bonkers.
Ivan says, Brian says, we'll get back to Ivan. Do you know of any other interesting rule bending or cheats like Lancia's antics versus Audi or Toyota's secret turbo restrictor plate adjustment?
So not really from an engineering point of view, but rally racing, you know what it's like. You're out in the woods, and it's like you're staging a war. And one of the greatest old cagiest guys, you may know him, John Buffum. He ran the original Audi Quattros in the U.S. He got he still has one of the original Quattros. He got Slobodan Zezada's original 911 from the factory, quasi-factory team from the Safari in the day. Like, this key was the rally king of the 70s and 80s. Anyway, he started running teams in the 90s and the noughties. And suddenly you'd be at a state rally stage turnaround. I was like, why is there a radiator sitting over in that tree over there? Like, wait a minute, there's two tires sitting over in that corner. Like, they would stash things in the woods.
Oh, they'd leave parts
out
there?
They'd leave parts, like, spread around the landscape. And, you know, they go then by the cover of night and collect them up. And I lost an international rally to him a lot of years ago now, 2002 or something, the Charlebois rally. And I thought, I mean, I had no idea how cagey he was, and I thought I was going to win the race, and he crushed me. So that's where age and treachery beats youth and ignorance all the time. So the answer is, I don't know any specific things, but I know that the older and cagier you are, the better you will succeed in rally and desert racing.
The Ivan says, what are your tips on braking, accelerating, and turning for beginner enthusiasts for better car control on the road and gravel off-road?
Gentle.
Lift, turn, brake.
Smooth inputs. Gentle inputs. You don't ever stab things.
Yeah.
You know this from the track even. You don't with the wheel. You know, unless, okay, for movies, take off all of that for stunt driving and for drift driving where you're intentionally trying to unsettle the car. But on gravel and snow, especially snow, much more than tarmac, I equate driving on tarmac to like driving a jet boat. Driving on dirt is like driving a cruiser, and driving on snow is like driving an ocean liner, because you have to make small inputs way ahead of time and then chase it with other small inputs. So the answer is smooth inputs. And if I can give one image for also smoothness, and this is, I think, stolen from some race school, but if you think of a string from the brake pedal to the bottom of the steering wheel, that as you, if you're braking, maximum braking, as you start to wind on the steering, it's got to pull up the brake pedal because that string is pulling it up. And then similarly, as you unwind the wheel, you can press the pedal back down. Make sense?
That's a good one. MCWAP 23, McWAP? I don't know what that is. Do you find it weird or awkward at all to drive right-hand drive cars in a spirited manner? I don't. It took a little getting used to, but it doesn't actually bother me at all. And I've done right-hand drive cars on track days and canyons, and actually find it rather fun.
Yeah, sucks for turning left in traffic and drive-through windows.
But that's about it.
But I drove an Australian Supra, like the proper Mark IV Supra. Mm-hmm. The guy got me to drive. He co-drove it, actually. That's a great deal. Hey, you want to drive my car? I'll co-drive. In Targa, Newfoundland a couple of times. Once you're in the zone, everything else melts away.
Yeah.
You know. Shifting with the left hand takes a second.
Just remember which direction the gears are, because I zinged a Focus RS in UK. I've been driving for like 5 minutes, and I was doing camera car on a track, and quickly went like, we need to go from 2 to 3, and I went, you know, this way instead of this way, and it just fucked
But it's, head. I mean, it's the same pattern, it's just with your other arm.
Same pattern, it was just like that muscle memory of like, and then we go outward, and it was like, no, we go inward with the left hand.
You know what I always mess up? Is the turn signals. I always turn a bunch of wipers.
My wife, who has two JDM right-hand drive cars.
Does she, or did you make her have those?
Make her?
Oh, well, okay.
No, she wanted both.
Okay.
She wanted, they're hers, and she wanted both.
What are they?
A Delica and a POW.
Both cool.
Both amazingly cool. Yeah. They're both downstairs.
Oh, yeah? I'll leave a Delica.
But the Delica's awesome. Mm-hmm. But she always fucks up the blinkers and wipers when she goes back to her regular American car.
100%.
Yeah. She doesn't fuck it up in the Japanese car.
Doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Well, if you drive in England, the blinkers are the same as America. They don't change
Japan, right?
Yeah.
I did live in England for a while.
Yeah. Chris Navio, what's been your favorite consultant project you've worked on?
Is it a question for me or you?
Oh, it's you.
Oh.
I don't do any consulting.
Well, so I'm lucky that I get to do stuff for Ford with some of the new products and things. So I love that. But I think back to your earlier thing, I think Hyperdrive, in a way. I didn't think of that show. I got to get on it because I didn't kill Charlize Theron in Atomic Blonde when I was done driving the car from the back seat. So then she executive produced that show, and she told her assistant to bring me on, and then I got to do the car stuff in that, right? Like to design. I didn't design all the courses. We all did it together. But some of the individual stunts and gags, right? The six story high teeter totter, the rail slide with the car. I eventually took that GTO that's outside up the rail slide.
Rad.
And so I was the sole guy who got to design all that stuff and, like, you know, say the car's going to work, it's not going to work, iterate it, test it. And then I got to coach 28 kids from around the world. We flew their cars in, right, to do that course. And they all ended up, because you know what reality shows can be like, and I've been on them, and we've done them before, and people usually end up pissed off. It's usually hard on people. Every one of those people to this day says it's the best experience they ever had. We got a good show out of it. It cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
A really good show. The stunts were legitimate. We created courses that were actually, one of the drifters was like, oh my God, you finally created time drifting, because you had to like weave in and out of these cones, although you couldn't do it without drifting it.
Yeah.
Where you're timed through it. We're really proud of it. So the answer is Hyperdrive.
It was a fun show
to watch.
Thank
you. Really,
I appreciate that. I'm still proud of that.
Yeah, it was a great show to watch. I think it's probably still on, you know, streaming, so you can
Netflix.
Still go back and watch it on Netflix.
I still get tiny royalty checks, so it must still be on.
Buddy. Is it down to like the dollar yet?
Oh yeah, it's some of them are in that range. Sure.
Yeah,
there's a restaurant or bar in North Hollywood. If you get a 1 cent residual check, you can get a free drink.
I think it's anything under a dollar.
Oh, is it?
I think
it's
the rule, because
I got a few.
I did a gig where I got residuals too, and the very last check was for zero. They send you one for zero to be like, we're done now.
Correct.
Don't even think about asking.
Yeah, they put
me.
Postage on it.
Yeah. IH cheese. Is the midsize truck segment going to die after this new generation of Tacoma and Colorado? SUVs are better commuters in cities, and full-size crew cab trucks do the job better. I would say that second part of that statement is your opinion. He says, I can see small trucks like the Maverick and Santa Cruz eating the mid-size truck category?
Well, I think the answer is there's probably room for lots of sizes of truck. I think both the Maverick and Santa Cruz are real interesting.
Yeah.
Like, they're good little trucks.
They stopped taking orders on the Maverick because they were like, oh, they're oversold.
Yeah.
So.
100%. I don't know the answer to that, but I think that for some people, the Maverick Santa Cruz will be too small and the full size is too big. So I think the answer is probably alive.
I mean, Toyota literally cannot build enough Tacomas, and that fucking thing is like 12 years old.
Yeah.
And
it's a great truck.
Yeah. And that is the right size truck for a lot of people. And I don't see why they would kill that segment. They're selling everyone they can build.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, you go to Overland Expo, I think they're all there.
Yeah. yeah, pretty much.
There, it's a good track.
Yeah. Well, that's our show today. Thank you all for joining us, ACP. Did we get to anything on your cheat sheet?
Yeah, pretty much. I want to talk to you. I want to talk about watches. I want to talk about other cars. I want to know all kinds of stuff.
Other shows, other times.
Yeah, yeah. But thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming down. I'm sorry for the weather and the traffic. Shit sucks.
He doesn't give a fuck about the weather. He drove across the ocean.
It's a good point.
See? Yeah. You know what's funny is that, like, not to extend your show, but, like, you know, I'm Canadian, right? And so, like, when it was minus 40, we'd go outside and, like, play and snowmobile and stuff. But when it's 65 in LA, I'm frozen, right? Because I'm not ready for it.
Right.
And I'm not ready for this rain.
Like, but your body also adjusts.
The buildings aren't meant for it. Like, the roads, the cars, like, your wiper blades haven't been used for a year.
They're squealing on the GTO.
Yeah.
You have to, here, it's so, like, dry, you have to change your wiper blades every time you change your oil.
Yeah.
And it's only rained, like, twice. It's, like, crazy.
We should do a zip tie. We should offer wiper blades. See?
You should.
I'd be more money.
You should.
Upsell.
Actually, that would be a good one.
Yeah.
That would be a good one. Check. Offer a free check. Wipe blades.
Zip wipe. It doesn't work.
No. It's just an add-on.
Zip blade.
It's just an add-on. Do you want a cookie with your sandwich?
Yeah. what else do we have this week? Someone got sick and had to cancel. Who was that?
Ferrara.
Oh, Adam Ferrara. Yeah, bummer.
I didn't want him anyway.
I love Adam Ferrara.
Yeah. We worked together in the day. Say hi for me. We worked together on the Top Gear days.
We will. We've got a Pro Driver show for the Pro Driver patrons on Thursday. And otherwise, we will see you guys next week. Bye.